Good morning, and thank you all for standing by. All participants will be on listen-only throughout the duration of today's conference call. Today's call is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'll turn the call over to your first speaker for today, Mr. Scott Winslow. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, and welcome to this board meeting of the President's Management Advisory Board that's originating from Washington, D.C. I'm Scott Winslow, the Executive Director and Designated Federal Officer of the President's Management Advisory Board, and I've got just a couple of housekeeping items that I want to take care of before we go ahead and get started. First, as the operator said, this is an open meeting, which means that members of the public can join us and listen to the proceedings of this call. And when we finish, an audio file of this will be loaded up to the President's Management Advisory Board website, which is hosted at whitehouse.gov. Second, I'd like to go ahead and do a quick roll call of the board members. Actually, I'll come to that in just a second. The other point that I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of is that the materials for this meeting have been posted to the PMAB website, so members of the public can download those and take a look at them. Those will be the materials that we'll be talking through during the course of this call. It's about 9 pages long. All of the board members should have received a document that is entitled President's Management Advisory Board Meeting Materials. As I said, it's about a nine-page document. Why don't I go ahead and turn to the last item of housekeeping, which is just to make sure that we can both recognize and take account of all the folks who are on the call. Greg Brown, are you here?
I am here.
Fantastic. Enrique Salem?
I am here.
Great. Liz Smith? Liz, are you there?
It looks like Liz's line has disconnected.
Okay. She'll probably join us in just a moment. Deborah Lee?
Yes, I'm on.
Great. Thank you. Gail McGovern?
I'm here.
Fantastic. And Ron Williams?
I am here.
Excellent. Jeff Zients, who is the chair of the board, will be with us in just a minute, and I'll announce when he joins us. He's just stepped out for a second. What I'd like to do is to very quickly orient you to how we're going to be spending our time across the course of this call. As I mentioned, the slide presentation is available to everyone. It lists all of the folks that I just listed. And if you could turn to page 3 inside of that that presentation, I just wanted to provide you with a sense of the purpose and the meeting of purpose of this meeting. And secondly, the agenda of how we'll be spending our time. This is a meeting of the President's Management Advisory Board where we're essentially taking recommendations from the two subcommittees that have been working across the course of this year. Those two subcommittees are working on strategic sourcing, so improving the usage of strategic sourcing inside the federal government, and secondly, improper payments, that is, finding ways to reduce the level of improper payments inside the federal government.
Scott, my apologies. It's Liz Smith. We were cut off.
Not a problem, Liz. I'm sorry if that was our fault.
No, it was ours. Please continue.
Thanks, Liz. With that, the two subcommittees have been working across the course of the year, doing a number of different things, having conversations with folks inside the federal government to understand the full range of the challenges that we face in both of those areas. We've had a few board meetings, which have taken place since we first picked these topics, and we are now convening to really hear the recommendations that that the subcommittees have put together. We will discuss those and then essentially adopt them going forward. If you take a look at page 4, that sort of enumerates the activity that's taken place across the course of the year. As I mentioned, board meeting back in March when we chose the two topics that we've been working on, we've had some independent meetings of the subcommittees. We've also had individual conversations with board members. We've also had the opportunity to work with some subject matter experts that the board members have pointed us to, and we have taken the opportunity to provide as detailed as possible overview of the challenges and the activity that's taking place inside the government against both of these initiatives. With all of that, we're coming together today to hear from the two subcommittees, as I mentioned. One of those is the Strategic Sourcing Subcommittee, which will go first. And we will be hearing from Ron Williams, who will essentially be taking us through that material. After Ron has had the opportunity to present and discuss that, we'll then move on to talk about the Improper Payments Subcommittee's work. And Enrique Salem will be taking us through that. At the end of that, just some quick next steps in advance of the next board meeting, which is scheduled for October 12th here in Washington. And then we should be able to move on to the rest of our days. With that, let me welcome Jeff Zients, who is the chairman of the President's Management Advisory Board. Jeff, welcome.
Hi, everybody.
We are just about to go ahead and get started, and I was just going to turn the microphone over to our first speaker on the Strategic Sourcing Subcommittee. Did you have anything you wanted to add, Jeff, before we went?
I think we're in person on the 12th of October. Is that
That's
right?
Correct.
And just making sure that we, have a robust next 5 weeks lock into the recommendations, so that we have actionable items on the 12th, meeting our goal of. The last time we were together on the 11th of July. So I think my read is we're in good shape, but we got
yes.
a lot of work to do across the next 5 weeks, and making sure that we, adopt these recommendations in both areas is today's goal. I don't know how you set this up, Scott, but my instinct would be to go through each section, take
Correct.
Any question or feedback as we go in those sections, and then do the formal adoption of the recommendations at the end of the two sessions. Does that make sense?
That's exactly what we were expecting to do.
Good, but let me not slow us down anymore, and I guess Ron is going to kick us off on strategic sourcing.
That's correct. Ron,
how are you?
I'm doing great. Good afternoon to everyone. And I would ask everyone to turn to page 5, and I won't read the page, but I will talk us through that to give you a sense of what we've learned and some of the work that the committee has done. Let me first thank my fellow committee members, subcommittee members, for their hard work and the work of the staffs in assisting us in this undertaking. I think the starting point really was the conversations that we had with the deputy secretaries, many of the acquisition officers, and the staff involved in the different agencies in terms of understanding what were the types of challenges that they faced. And that was important to understand the differences between the solutions that work in the private sector and some of the solutions that may or may not work in the government sector. But I think it gave the committee a solid grounding to identify some of the things that the government's facing. Some of those included a significant deficit in data and information on which to base the decisions. I think the others centered around the challenge of aligning incentives up and down the system so that everyone who was asked to engage in a program activity had the right incentive that aligned with program goals. And I think the other issue is really the whole question of getting the right kind of collaboration across the agencies in ways that refer to the objective. I think the subcommittee, as a result of that, looked at a lot of the leading practices with an eye to addressing these types of deficiencies. So I think the things that we set out to accomplish were really to make certain that the government could issue and communicate very clear policy guidance, that the recommendations would result in a utilization of some of the vehicles that might be put in place, and that a governance structure that was appropriate to the setting could in fact be implemented, and that governance structure would have the right accountability mechanisms as part of it. I think one of the other things that we viewed as an important objective was to look at the centralized knowledge management tools and make certain that the tools that were developed made sense. They provided the kind of data that would support the implementation and capture of the savings that we felt could come forward from the program. And I think the final thing that we felt would be important to address in the recommendations was how to create a playbook that, while being very specific about what to do and how to do it, and would share best practices would allow opportunity for creativity and for appropriate targeting and adaptation to the particular agencies involved. So I would pause there before I shift to the specific recommendations themselves and give my committee members a chance to add anything they might wish to add.
That was a good report. I don't have anything to add. This is Debbie Lee.
Thanks, Debbie. Gail, did you have anything to add to what Ron has walked us through?
Nope. I think that was well done, Ron. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ron. Thank you, Gail and Debbie. Ron, go ahead.
Moving to the recommendations that the committee has developed, I would start with page 6, and I think the most important thing is really developing the right government-wide policy directives. And the way we thought about assuring that those were fact relevant was to look at the attributes. For example, one of the policy directives, three key criteria, was making certain that they mandate the use of government-wide strategic sourcing where appropriate. Now, when you have where appropriate, there's always a challenge as to is that the loophole through which everyone rushes. And I think that's one of the things I think the policy has to look at and where some of the accountability will come in is the only way the government can really get the kind of savings that we believe is possible is if people really do adopt the strategic sourcing as a fundamental programmatic initiative in their agency. One of the ways we thought was a critical recommendation to do that was to set ambitious government-wide goals for the creation and adoption of these vehicles, and those goals would reflect savings in the different categories that would be appropriate to each agency. But it really is important that they be ambitious and that they require creativity and creative thinking to get there. The final part of the policy directive was really to make certain that the policy required an accountable senior official within each agency who would both oversee the program and where there would be judgments made about their contribution to the program as a part of their overall performance management. Second major category of recommendations centered around data collection and utilization in the decision-making process. And it's extremely important that the right level of data be obtained and that there be an effective analysis of the data that results in meaningful conclusions from which action can be based. So it's not how much data do you collect, it's what do you actually do with the data in the course of human events. One of the ways we thought this could be enhanced would be to consider the use of request information on cost data from the vendors that the government actually works with. And this could be done as a prerequisite to government solicitations because often the vendors actually have a better holistic view of all of their government transactions than the individual agencies do. And finally, in terms of data collection utilization, we felt it was important to develop standardized performance tracking and reporting. And standardized can be developed in a collaborative process with the different agencies, but it has to be certain that everyone is being judged on the same basis because otherwise you may get a special view of the universe that shows that everyone is, in fact, achieving their individual goals, but holistically we're not necessarily achieving the goals that we set out to achieve. Third major category, it really centers around communication. And it's really about designing an effective communication program that makes certain that the message and the intent of the program is understood at all levels of the organization. And that means that it's necessary to syndicate not simply top-down messages, but bottom-up messages that are both written and in some instances different media, town hall meetings, video conferences. And that it's important to validate through surveys and other mechanisms that the fidelity of the message has been delivered to the front line so that people really understand the intent of the program and the results and why it is important to the government and to their agencies. Another important part of communication is really celebrating all the successes, particularly the early successes and even some of the smaller successes, to show people that accountability is important, and two, the program is being measured, monitored, and success is being recognized. And finally, in terms of communication, I think it's important that the senior-most leaders highlight their progress through the President's Management Council, which is the senior-most operating council of the government, and that they hold each other accountable for achieving the kind of progress that has been planned for and committed to. But I would pause there and again ask my colleagues if there's anything they would like to supplement.
No comment. Again, that was great. Thanks, Ron.
Ron, the only thing that I would add, this is Gail, is that on the subcommittee there were a number of anecdotal pieces of evidence as well as hard data of our colleagues that have done this and have had remarkable results. And so I think the way you laid this out was extremely well put, and even though the language is strong, like mandate the use of government-wide strategic sourcing, the experience from the subcommittee was that it's essential to use that type of language and to take those kinds of actions for the results to take place. And the less you can make optional, the stronger the results.
Right. Yeah, this is Debbie again. Just to add to what Gail said, there was some anecdotal evidence that people that have been through this were surprised to find that everyone didn't have the same goals and objectives. So saving money from budgets, even though it comes down from the top, may not be what lower level employees see, or even some executives. So that's why we thought the strong language of mandating was critical to make sure that people abided by the objectives and the goals that were laid out by the top management.
Ron, this is Joe from OMB. I just want to say thank you for these recommendations. They certainly resonate. I think they're a very good synthesis of what my team heard during our interactions with the subcommittee, during our site visits, and during that July 11th meeting. I also want to just thank the entire subcommittee, including Tim and Sam, who couldn't join this call but were integral to our efforts. Dan Tangerini from GSA, who I know is on the call, and I are really excited to partner together on this. We think that we can move pretty quickly and really achieve some significant impact. And I think that as I look through these recommendations that the subcommittee is proposing, they certainly make a lot of sense and are things that we look forward to implementing.
Yeah, this is Jeff. I think that the mandate is key here. I mean, if we were talking about marginal areas where you could argue both ways, then I'd be more hesitant. But given that we've got some areas that are just so obvious we should be doing this together, and we have a history of not doing it that way, I think the risk-reward is very much tilted in the direction of let's do some mandates. And I think we can get the President's Management Council on board for it.
Great.
Then we got to execute and really nail it. But I think without it, we're just going to be chasing this opportunity rather than getting ahead of it or catching up to it.
Well, that's very encouraging to hear. And I would really echo Gail's and Debbie's comments that the businesses that have done this have found very substantial savings as a result of implementing strategic sourcing, and often the quality of the services have been improved as well. So I think that's extremely important to keep in mind, that we're not sacrificing quality to produce savings. And I think that the variability that was reported in some of the sessions of some of the purchases that are occurring clearly point out that there are very substantial savings available for tax. Great to see this level of engagement.
Good.
Excellent. Ron, thank you very much. And before I turn the microphone over to Enrique to take us through the improper payments recommendations, Greg, Enrique, Liz, did you all have any comments or questions?
I think it's well done. And some of the issues that Ron mentioned and the team mentioned are similar to to what we found on the improper payment side, that some of the things that we see in the private sector and the way we can structure incentives is a little bit more difficult in the public sector. So we found similar things.
Yeah, I just was really wanted to double down on Ron's point, which I think was an excellent one, that when you engage in this process, you find obviously real cost efficiencies, but also coincident with that, quality improvements. That's been my experience, is the two go hand in hand. So as Ron said, it's a win-win.
Excellent. Enrique, why don't you kick us off into the improper payments recommendations?
Sure, absolutely. So I'm on slide 7, and I'm going to touch on 7 and then probably spend most of my time on 8. Our subcommittee was Jeff Kindler, Liz Smith, Greg Brown, and myself, and we've had a number of subcommittee meetings really focused on how do we get the right scope for this improper payments area to make sure that we can get some real tangible results. If we start on the slide, obviously a number of different interviews with deputy secretaries and agency leaders, and we found some specific issues around what were their challenges as they try to attack the improper payments area. Just to recap, in fiscal year 2011, improper payments was $115 billion. Now, we should also comment that progress has been made in this area. There was a mandate that came out to try and save about $50 billion of this number. We're about $20 billion into it so far in work that was done over the last several years. Most of that $20 billion has come from the Medicaid and Medicare area. And that does represent, by the way, Medicare and Medicaid represents 55% of the total improper payments area, the next big area being unemployment insurance at about 13.7. What we've done is, as we've gone through the various areas, some of the progress has been good by things like creating a center of excellence at the Department of Labor to start focusing on this unemployment insurance area. Also, the Treasury Department has created the Do Not Pay Initiative, which is a very visible area where payments are being made that obviously shouldn't. And then lastly, how do we create a better set of data that will allow us to reduce improper payments and reduce operational mistakes? One other thing that the subcommittee did that we found was very helpful is the team went out and visited Aetna to try and understand how do they think about using data to better run their business. And this is very important because what the team really learned beyond having good tools is just what was the tone inside of the organization. And at Aetna, one of the things that the team found was a lot of the data is used to try and figure out how do we minimize procedures from happening that are unnecessary. And it's not necessarily the topic that mattered. What really mattered was that the organization understood that that was important to the success of the business. And that's what we want to try to get in what we do in improper payments, is that everybody understands why this is really important, what are the incentives that are going to have a meaningful impact on reducing improper payments. And so, Ron, the visit to the team at Aetna was very helpful. And what was interesting is just how clear everybody inside the organization, at least that the team talked to, said it wasn't about the data, it's about the end goal, which is reducing the number of procedures that are being done that shouldn't be. And I don't know, Ron, if you want to comment at all on that, but that was clearly a message that the team took away.
Yeah, I think it comes back to the quality question. This is fundamentally about making certain that the quality of care that people receive is the right care, and that clinicians make decisions about at what point does something become excessive to the extent that it may dangerous, in addition to raising the cost of care. So quality comes back to be a very central element of it all.
Yeah, and this is Danny from OMB, and I just again want to thank the folks at Aetna for spending time with us and giving us a deep dive into how they approach data analytics, and to echo what Enrique said. What was very clear is that the tools themselves were very impressive, and we're going to learn a lot from understanding how corporations are tapping into those emerging technologies for how to look at data. So that in and of itself was beneficial. But what was even more striking than that was how clear the business leaders within the organization understood some of the bottom line metrics that had been established by Aetna leadership, how they were held accountable for those bottom line business metrics. And that is what spawned the very aggressive and sophisticated use of data. It was very clear to us that it wasn't that Aetna had spent a lot of time kind of trying to cultivate within the organization, how do we do data? How do we get data integrated into our work? The reality was that you set clear performance objectives for the overall business, and the data solutions emerge just because you have talented people trying to meet those metrics and help the company be successful. And so we really went back and thought a lot about incentives and the tone that our organizations are setting within government for expected results and how that can help us in this area.
So again, very, very helpful in setting up the context of what we want to do. And so now let's turn our attention to page 8, which is really the specific recommendations and what we think we should focus on. The two areas that we think we should focus on and are focused on are, one, the unemployment insurance area, which makes up 13.7% of the improper payments, and then, two, the Do Not Pay program at the Treasury. Starting on unemployment insurance, what we found were that there's a whole range of performance across the various states. And just to give you some numbers, and this is publicly available data that the team has, 9 states currently have the lowest improper payment rates. It's in the 4-6% range. States like Kansas, Oklahoma, Kentucky, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Hawaii. And then there are 12 states that have an improper payment rate of greater than 14%. Ohio, Indiana, Virginia, South Carolina, Nebraska, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. And so it's interesting because this starts putting a light on some of the work that we need to do going forward if we're going to attack this problem and really solve or make some meaningful progress. So as we looked at our recommendations, in general, the team would put them in these buckets. One, on slide 8, bullet 1 and 5 really talk about where is the opportunities to drive the savings. Where can we really start attacking the improper payment area? Bullet number two is the tone at the top. So is the person in charge of, is the workforce administrator and the governor's office really focused on this improper payments area? Numbers 3 and 4 are really around the incentives. Number 6 is, again, how do we better use data to identify the profile of people who are potentially repeat offenders or repeatedly getting improper payments that we want to curtail and potentially identify individuals. And then number 7 is make sure that we're using this data effectively. Now, the thing that's interesting here is, and this is a bit of what Ron said, when we talked about the incentive area, the challenge is in the private sector, we know how to very effectively tie performance to the rewards. One of the things that happens, though, that we learned through this process is when the workforce administrator is looking at all the work that they have to do, if they drive savings in improper payments, that actually is not directly tied to the state budget. That comes out of the payroll tax, employee payroll tax services. And while it's obviously a good thing to reduce what businesses are paying, it's not directly tied to potentially the incentives that that individual has. And the important point there is they manage a number of different programs that could really put us in a situation where they could be doing overall a job that is acceptable to the governor's office, but may not be doing a great job in this area. And so what the team is really going to think through is what are the appropriate incentives that start driving a meaningful change in behavior, because there is, again, in the order of, $14 billion that could be saved here. So our specific recommendations and what we'd like to do is get a small number of states, what we'll call the early adopters, and pick from the list. We could pick, I listed some examples of folks who are doing a better job than others, and we're working on who are those early adopters and a mix of potentially folks who have real opportunities for savings and folks who are doing a good job. And what we want to do is make sure that we work with them closely to figure out how do we create the right incentive structure to reduce improper payments. And two, how do we make sure that we drive the right level of accountability? The third thing that we want to do is we've got to get an ability to use data much better. There's a wealth of data that's not yet being fully exploited, and some of the work that we saw in the site visits is that there's a real opportunity, because if we can identify the profile of individuals who are potentially receiving improper payments, we can go a long way to start to reduce those payments. And then lastly, we're going to work through how would we actually execute and implement the best practices and recommendations that we learn from the various states. But what is very clear here is that there is a lot of opportunity in the unemployment insurance frame to drive some real savings. And we fundamentally believe that it is going to be around the incentives, making sure that we have the right tone at the top of the state leadership, making sure we use data more appropriately, and then making sure that these recommendations get adopted broadly across the various UI, the various unemployment insurance groups inside the states. So that's where we are right now from a set of recommendations from our subcommittee. Liz, Greg, any other thoughts?
No, I think that's a great summary, Enrique. This is Greg. I think at the end of the day, as you kind of sort through all this, you can think about how we're proceeding in four categories in terms of improper payments: avoiding, saving, prioritizing, and institutionalizing. Enrique talked about the avoiding of improper payments of $50 billion by the end of 2012, the savings that we're embarking upon coming from an all-time high of 5.4% in 2009 and working it to almost half that by the end of 2014, the prioritization around the states and the specific pilots around Treasury do not pay and labor unemployment insurance, and then institutionalizing is the fourth, around incentives, accountability, and leading ultimately, hopefully, towards some centralized verification, centralized database, centralized capacity, so that the deployment of a portal and data analytics over time, over a few years, can unite all agencies. So that's the path we're on, and Enrique has done a great job, along with everyone else on the subcommittee.
Well said.
Excellent. Denny?
I just want to express my appreciation as kind of the government lead on this area for the work that was done and is going to continue to be done. The only additional substantive point I'd make on the real opportunity we have in working with the states is that, if you look at the improper payments portfolio, we really have historically studied the data. It has been more difficult for us to gain traction and reduce our errors when we have state-administered programs. And the reason is because we have 50 different operations to work with and a variety of different complex stakeholders. And this UI pilot that we're launching is going to be a very important first step in beginning to tackle of the challenges that we have in working with states and getting some central solutions among the states in this area. And I'm very appreciative of the emphasis on incentives and the action plan here to really work closely, develop partnerships with some key state stakeholders, and start to sort through what are the best approaches for developing the right incentive structure. I think that's going to have value not just for UI, but other state-administered programs like Medicaid, where there's improper payments and a lot of opportunities for improvement. So with that, just again, thank you for all the work.
Well, one small but maybe helpful thought here is, having just seen former Governor Warner yesterday, I'm surprised Virginia is an outlier in terms of a high rate. In most areas, Virginia's setting a standard for well-managed. I don't know if that slipped since Warner was governor and Kane, but it'd be interesting to get to Warner because Warner is such a good management person with the business background he has to understand Virginia's issue and the transferability of best practices and incentives and all the rest. So,
Jeff, one comment. The data, just to punctuate that, we'll definitely obviously know Governor Warner, and he's done so many great things. I would tell you the data ends the data goes to June 2011. So, you know, obviously there's been another almost year plus since then, and we just don't have the most current data. But again, we'll follow up with the governor.
Yep. Excellent. Any last comments before I kind of turn this over to Jeff, and then we kind of close out the meeting? Yep. Jeff, just in terms of recommendations.
So do you need a formal?
Exactly. If you would like to put forward for adoption the recommendations from the subcommittees.
Okay. Do I have a second on that?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Anyone against? All right. Sounds like we formally have the recommendations, and we are back together on October 12th, which I guess gives us about 5 or 6 weeks to ensure that we continue this progress and have actionable items for the 12th. I'm hoping everybody can make it.
Exactly.
And thank you again for all the hard work. I can't tell you how big a difference it's making on these terrains and as we continue to drive on the SES and IT terrains.
The initiatives from last year.
Yeah, we have real tangible progress that we'll highlight on those terrains, and I look forward to similar results on both strategic sourcing and improper payments. So thank you, everybody. I know it's a lot of hard work, and know that it has a very high return.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks,
everybody.
Thanks. Bye. You have a good weekend.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Thanks, everybody.